and to remind people, especially those who are Chicano Mexicano descent, we are indigenous people. We didn't cross the border, we didn't come with the pilgrims. And it's important that they realize that. It's in our DNA and it's in our genealogy. That's why we have been discriminated, because if we were European Spaniards, we wouldn't have the problem. That's the problem. Because of our indigenous blood, we have been discriminated against. And we respect all people, whether you're indigenous or not. The four corners, the four directions, the four races of mankind, the white, the red, the black, the yellow. Chicano, Mexicano people are under the red because we are indigenous people. And Asleca came here to do a blessing. We appreciate all people who come to support the Chicano, Mexicano people who have been dying at the border. And that's why we came here to honor, most of all, to honor those who have died at the border, the 3,000 of our indigenous Mexicanos, Chicano people, and other Latino people from South America, whoever crossed the border. Ale Dios, Mexica Tiawe.
thank you very much. And now we have an indigenous speaker from the Otomi Nation, Mexico. Senor.
Thank you very much. We are the Mexica people.
Is moving forward. Mexica Tiawi, we are moving forward. El es Dios.
El es Dios.
We're going to do our presentation now. And thank you for the mic for the ceremony.
Yo puedo traducir, pero si nadie lo necesita, pues... Usted...
Sorry.
You can't be near the speaker.
Thank you. Okay. Perdónenme, por favor. Si alguien quiere traducción, ¿puede levantar la mano, por favor? So nobody needs translation. Okay. So then I guess we'll do the workshop in English only. Just give us a couple minutes, please.
I was going to say good morning, but it's not morning anymore. But I'm happy to be here with my brothers and my sisters, and I thank the maestro for doing the blessing for us this morning. I'm Marta Frausto. I'm with the Otomi Coordination Project. We're really housed in Fresno, but we're a California organization. And I'm honored to be here to talk about something that's near and dear to my heart. That's ourselves. And I saw and happy to see that some of our young Fresno people are here. Paul, that boy Sean, Lizette, and Sophia. I'm happy they're here. What we're going to do is talk about Mexican indigenous communities in California, but it's hard to talk about us being in California without understanding our binational nature. And in the late 1800s, the U.S. government adopted a law called the Dawes Act. And basically what it was a way to take the reservation lands that the tribes got through treaties, and it was a way to disown the tribes from those lands by giving them the individual allotments. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because this is a very similar mechanism that is being used in Mexico right now through NAFTA, where they're taking the ejido systems, communal land system, ownership systems that were created in the 1930s by President Cárdenas. And what they're doing now is doing the same thing, where they're offering indigenous people fee simple individual ownership in order to break down those ejido systems. So we can see very similar things that are happening to Mexican indigenous people that have happened to the Native Americans in the United States. What we're going to cover today is I'm going to have Ricardo Tapia, who's with the Pascua Yaqui Nation in Arizona. Even though he lives here in California, he's a member of his tribe. He will talk about Yaquis. And the Yaquis, incredible people, because they're one of the first Mexican indigenous people who came into Mexico with maintaining their identity. And they are the only Mexican indigenous or ethnic group in the United States that is federally recognized. So he will cover the dynamics of his people. I will then cover the Otomíes in California and in Mexico, and then our compañero Rogelio Mendez will talk about the Frente Indígena de Organizaciones Binacional And then I'll do a summary of how, you know, some of our relations are developing among ourselves and internationally, and hopefully with some of your organizations. And with that, I'll hand this over to Ricardo, and you can talk to us about Yaquis.
I want to greet you in our way, and to again, you know, thank the maestro for the opening our portion of our talk with the ceremony. In that way, it's always important for us to center ourselves whenever we're going to do something important, and that's where ceremony comes in for us. As Yaquis, as Martha said, you know, we have been one of the tribes in Mexico who was never conquered by the Spanish. In fact, we defeated the Spanish several times. That's why they couldn't conquer us. They didn't get the message the first time, so they came back a few more times, you know. So we had to do it again. Our territory is in Sonora, which is the coast of Mexico, from Baja Mexico, Baja California, and it borders Arizona and New Mexico. When they say borders, it's sort of funny because whenever you read anything by the anthropologists, you got to take it with a grain of salt. Sonora, Arizona, and Sonora, Mexico are one and the same. So as I think Steve or one of the speakers here earlier said, the border didn't cross us. We didn't cross the border crossed us. For us, it is in fact nothing but the truth. We are in Sonora. How many of you people know what a saguaro cactus looks like? Okay, the saguaro cactus is that cactus that has arms. And the saguaro cactus, you only find it in Sonora. So that is in Arizona and in Mexico. All that is our part of our territorial reach. So we don't border Arizona and New Mexico. We go beyond the borders. So those borders, again, crossed us. Our initial contact with the Spanish was in 1531, after they'd gone through and defeated quite a few people, came to our area, we defeated them, and we did it again in 1608, 1609, and 1610, when they came back again with more forces. But one of the things that did help them in finally getting access to our land was religion. Since they couldn't do it with war, and it wasn't something they planned, it's something that happened. The Jesuits, when they came into our area, they came through the Mayos. We had a territorial, you look at the Gulf right there, the Fuerte River, the Mayo River, and the Yaqui River. Those are the rivers that part of our border, all the way up, like I said, into Arizona, and into Tumacacori, into Mexico, New Mexico. So our area is quite extensive. We're one of the few tribes, again, you know, that there's two tribes you didn't want to mess with in the Southwest. That was the Apaches and the Yaquis. And what happened, again, getting back to the Jesuits, when they went through our cousin tribes, the Mayos, they carry that rosary with a crucifix. Well, for us, the cross, it's an even cross, not like a crucifix, is a sun sign. So for us, it was a thing of interest. What did that cross mean? So when they talked to the Mayos about it, the Mayos became converted. And then they sort of ushered the Jesuits into our area, and that they explained about the whole story about the cross. So our people were really interested in it, and I thought, they've got the same sign as us. It's a little bit lopsided, you know, but it's almost the same sign. And they were talking about the Son of God. We're talking about the sun. So they thought, let me see what's going on here, the parallels. So what happened was, that was in fact the way that they finally, the Spanish, gained access into our area. So they set up some churches. And the Jesuits at first, they seemed to demonstrate good faith by going against the state and then, you know, trying to protect our people from mining, forced mining, and other things they're trying to do with us once people became converted. And it happened more or less for us between 1613 to 1617 is when the conversion took place for most of our people. And then the Jesuits turned to be tyrants. There was actually 80 pueblos, or rancherias, what they call them, the Spanish called them, but for us it was settlements, or at least over 80 settlements. We had 7 original towns. When the Jesuits came in, the 8th town became created sort of like as an oversight town, and in that oversight capacity, the Jesuits assumed a lot of control. And since the people thought, okay, everything's okay, they finally, our people started getting upset when the Jesuits didn't allow our people that self-autonomy that we're used to, electing our own officials. We're an agricultural community also, so we had a lot of storage, you know, our storage surpluses were full, and they were using some of that food to go up into California and other places for their expeditions. So once they were in our area, they continued up north. So what happened with our people, we became upset, you know, when all our storage foods were being emptied, there was a flood, and then that's when the people started getting upset again. So we had several wars. And during those times, when we fought with the Spanish, then we later on, when Mexico became independent around 1822, then we had problems with them also. When Cárdenas was the president, he's actually one of the presidents that did recognize us. Another president from Mexico is Álvaro Obregón, and actually he was Mayo, cousin tribe. So we did have a lot of success. When you look at the Mexican Revolution, you look at Pancho Villa, he had a group of Yaquis. Álvaro Obregón was fighting on the side of Mexico, and he had Yaquis. There was Yaquis on both sides, but we wouldn't fight against each other. What happened was, later on, you know, as things developed, whenever we had a war, we'd go up into the mountains. So there's, the strategy for the Mexicans was to contain our water hose, tie up our people, send them to different places. So our migration was, again, pretty extensive because of our land reach, our Aboriginal reach. So the history of Native people in the Americas is at least 40,000 years old, according to some of our oral traditions and some of the findings. 40,000 years. This border is not that old, okay? So when we look at that, you put it into a historical perspective, you say, what's wrong with this picture? So it's a geopolitical boundary that's been forced upon us. What happens, where's MacGyver when you need him? His duct tape's not working. So what happens is that our people, again, you know, once the Mexican government started doing this, since we're talking about migration, there was also a forced migration of our people. Some of our people, because the government was afraid of us, whenever there would be a war and there would be enemies captured, they would ship some of our people to Oaxaca to do plantation work. They'd send some of our people to Veracruz to do plantation work, sort of as in slaves. So what happened is that's the forced migration. And all throughout this area, you know, our people would come back. It's just like when Geronimo surrendered in 1868. He was sent all the way to Florida. That's how afraid they were of him as well. So the same thing with the Yaquis. You know, they would try and ship us up, break us up, and it was actually genocide. At first they were afraid, but once they got a foothold, once the Mexicans came in, once there was peace made, once forts were set up, then they invited Mexicans to come in. This area, again, it's about maybe 10% of the area of Mexico, which is pretty significant. Mexico, by the way, is bigger in reality. This is a U.S. map, so showing Mexico small. It's such another thing I want to bring to your attention. But for about 10% of the land, it's also one of the most fertile areas. So right there, because you've got the alluvial floodplain coming from the Sierras, it's by the, you got three rivers, we got the ocean. So it's a very rich area, very fertile. The area here in California, the San Joaquin Valley, is called like the breadbasket of the world, because that's also very, very rich and fertile. So it feeds part of the world. For us, this was very rich. That's another reason the Mexican government wanted it. They wanted it for mining, for agriculture, and before you know it, the demise of our people, we were in the way, just like anything else. So just as our world was turned upside down, so was the plant world, so was the animal world, the water world, the natural world, everything throughout the Americas. We call this Turtle Island. And we don't separate it all the way from Point Barrow, Alaska to Tierra del Fuego. That's all Indian land. And we have to be careful when people use their terminology. You know, they go, the Far East, but they point west. Go, well, that confused us. You know, they talk about Easters, and then we go, wow, they really confused us that time with rabbits laying eggs, you know. So we get confused, you know, very easily, and when we're concerned. And we're very concerned when they were lying to us, but we became paranoid when they started lying to you. because it's one thing for them to lie to us, but when they lie to their own people, that's bad news. So for us, the truth is something that's very important, and it's something they can never take away from us, something they can never fight and destroy. And the truth is what we come to share with you today. The border issues, we're very concerned. That's why I was really glad to hear that panel before us. Action is something that needs to take place. For those of you that are doing it, I commend you. I applaud you. For those of you that aren't at this point, this is an excellent opportunity for you to get involved. We as Yaquis have been fighting since 1531. One of our last wars officially was right around the time of World War I. So around 1916, 1920, we're still fighting. And here in the U.S., as Martha said, we're one of the few tribes from Mexico that became recognized in the U.S. Our people, the Pascua Yaqui Association in the Tucson area, they fought to get recognized. They went to Congress, they went all over the place, and then they fought with congressional people, and then one congressman told one of our spiritual leaders and traditional leaders, he goes, well, to be Indian here, to be an American Indian, you have to be born in America. Well, we know it's all America, but he was talking about the U.S., right? So he says, born in the U.S. So he says, well, thank you for calling me an American Indian. And shortly thereafter, we became recognized in 1978. I want to remind you that 1924 is when Indians became recognized in the U.S., not too long ago. I want to remind you that in 1978, we as Indian people finally got freedom of religion. I want to remind you that the Constitution was taken from the Indian people, the Iroquois Nation. I want to remind you that Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson stole it and got the credit for doing it. And it wasn't until 500 years later that the U.S. admitted it came from us. I want to remind you that our Constitution enabled women to be part of it. And in fact, the women were the ones that if you were a leader and you weren't taking care of business, they'd give you three warnings. After the third warning, you're not a leader anymore. I want to remind you our Constitution did not have slavery. I want to remind you, we are very educated people. When the Spanish came looking for our riches throughout the Americas, they didn't realize our riches was our knowledge. Oh.
Thank you, Ricardo. I'm going to talk about the Otomi. And our original, Otomi is what we're known as, but our original, what our name, our what we call ourselves, are Ñañu. And the word Otomi is what the Aztecs used to call us, and it's kind of stuck. It's sort of like how the Purepechas are known as Tarascos, but, you know, they've reclaimed their original name, which is Purepecha. We've gone to similar identity issues, I suppose, but anyhow. You know, we're very different in that when you talk about Yaquis or you talk about Mixtecos, there's a very definite geographical area that you can point to, and this is La Mixteca, you know, Bajo and Alta, or Yaqui, the Yaquis are in Sonora. And we are the original inhabitants of Central Mexico. And we've been hanging around there, we know at least 10,000 years, and probably more like 30. But what happened was we started seeing tribes that were coming from the north, and I won't name them, but probably some of them are familiar to you. So we consider them sort of our traditional enemies, because when they came around, we just kind of had to run off to get away from them. And so we migrated, and this is in pre-Columbian times. We migrated to the north, the northwest, and to the northeast. And today, we are scattered all over the place. We are in the states of Guanajuato, Hidalgo, the state of Mexico, Michoacán, Puebla, Querétaro, San Luis Potosí, Tlaxcala, Veracruz, and of course, Mexico, Distrito Federal. And that has really caused a lot of problems for us in terms of organizing, because we're a lot of little scattered communities all over these 9 states. But in any case, we do still exist, and we have survived. And of course, with the European invasion, with the conquest, Central Mexico was the hardest hit during the conquest, and of course that made our dispersion even more. We dispersed even more. So my family, we're from Guanajuato, and so we're some of the northwesternmost area of where you find Otomi people. Anyway, the Otomi Coordination Project are really an arm of the Consejo de la Nación Otomi. In other words, our nation, you know, our organization as a nation, which is housed in Mexico. But the Otomi Coordination Project is an arm of the nation. And it's for the purposes of organizing Otomi in California. Now, you know, there's debate about how many there are of us. The government says, oh, you're like 300 or 600,000. And Consejo de la Nación Otomi says we're 5.5 million. And of course, well, I'll go into more detail later, but you know, it's we're saying that about half of those people of the 5.5 million speak Otomi. So we have survived, and we still speak our language, and we have our ceremonies. And more important is that when you say Otomi, people go, what the hell is that? You know, well, anyway, a lot of that is because we've chosen to be obscure. We're kind of trying to not draw attention to ourselves as a survival mechanism. So, the Otomi are concentrated in the state of Mexico because that's where originally where the biggest concentrations are, and you still find a lot of the concentration there. They say that about 95% of the Otomi in Mexico live in poverty or extreme poverty. We have an important place in history because we were involved in the War of Independence with Father Miguel Hidalgo, who spoke Otomi, and had about 800,000 army of where we think the majority of those were Otomi. And of course, thousands of Otomis were involved in the Mexican Revolution. We were some of the original Zapatistas, and we're proud of being part of the Mexican Revolution. You know, in terms of migrations of Otomi into the United States, we're having a lot of difficulty or putting our finger on it. The way you can talk about the Yaquis, it's very clear when they were coming, with the Mixtecos, we know when they were coming, and that kind of thing. It's been very difficult for us to put a finger on, well, this is exactly when we came. My hunch is that it was during the Mexican Revolution and into and probably part of the Bracero program in that time period is where. And of course, what's happening with the when the Yaquis came and when the Mixtecos and the Oaxaqueños coming, a lot of the indigenous people that came over during those time periods kind of chose to blend in, you know, because that was the survival mechanism. And I think that we're probably a good example of that. And but one of the things, patterns that I find with Otomi is that somehow they hold on to or connect with the spiritual movements of the United States, or indigenous spiritual movements. So you see a lot of Otomi who are sun dancers. You see them involved in the bear dances. You see them involved in the traditions of the Nahua-speaking people, like we saw earlier today. So we attach ourselves to spiritual movements because it's one of the ways to maintain an indigenous identity, and because, you know, a lot of times when I grew up, we were the only Otomi we ever knew were, oh, my brothers and my sisters, my cousins. You know, we didn't know other Otomi. And funny, because I'm finding people that are Otomi, I never knew, I've known them, but I didn't know they were Otomi. So that's an interesting dynamic within our community. My father, parents, who would say my grandparents, died of typhoid during the Mexican Revolution and were left orphaned, and as an orphan migrated to the north and was in the Yosemite Valley in the late 1920s. And of course that's being a result of the Mexican Revolution and the disruption of daily life in Central Mexico. There was a couple of points I wanted to say in terms of trying to maintain identity and tradition, is that we have difficulties with that even in Mexico, because to the areas that we migrated to escape, then you had migrations into those areas. So, and then, you know, so there was a lot of disruption to tradition and to and culture. I don't think that's unique to Otomi. I think that happens to a lot of other Mexican indigenous communities, not only in Mexico, but here in the United States as well. One of the things that has happened is that the Consejo de la Nación Otomi made an outreach to us in the United States and said, hey, we're looking for Otomi. And at their urging is how we created the Consejo. Well, the Consejo de la Nación Otomi, you know, asked us to create the Otomi Coordination Project. So it's not something that we've, you know, made up. It's something that has come at the urging of our relations in Mexico. And for that, I'm grateful. Otherwise, we'd still be hanging around without a specific attachment or relation to our relations in Mexico. So, of course, a lot of our work is around the recovery and strengthening of cultural identity and the emphasis of cultural decolonization. One of the things that happened in Mexico that proved to be very powerful was the creation of the Otomi Ceremonial Center, or the Centro Ceremonial Otomi, and that was a ceremonial center built, funded, and by our people. And so that's become our ceremonial center. That's where the Congreso, our Congress meets. It's our spiritual center, and it's just something to be really proud of, and it brings cohesion to our communities. It was built in the early 1980s, and those of you who travel to Mexico City, if you go to Toluca, there's a little community outside of Toluca called Temoaya, and it's about half an hour from Temoaya, and it's a place, it's a beautiful place, and I encourage those of you who travel to Mexico to go and see this place. It's become an important place for us as Otomi people. And of course, our work right now is to identify other Otomi brothers and sisters in the United States. We know we are in Florida, we're in Vermont, we're in New York, California, and Texas, and my suspicions are probably throughout the Southwest. And of course, the work that our spiritual elders do in trying to bring us back to the ceremonies in Mexico, and at the Centro Ceremonial, and you know, like our people in Mexico still use the temezcal every 3 days. So we have traditions that, you know, we're grasping onto and trying to create over in here in the United States, because we as tradition. We go to the sweat lodges of the California Indian and Indians from the United States, but we have our own temezcal, which is different, but it's, you know, it's part of our tradition. In any case, we now are working between the Otomi in Mexico and the United States. We have a delegation of Otomi from California that are traveling to the Congreso, Otomi Congress in the end of October. So we're looking forward to that and working towards that. And I think that we say that more or less there's about 400 Otomi communities in Mexico. And so what we're trying to do is connect the Otomi from here to those regions where their families are from and make those connections. And of course, you know, building up the membership. The Otomi in Mexico telling us where the relations are in the U.S. so that we can track them down and say, hey, hi, you guys, you know, we're trying to talk to you. And my family is organized as a clan of Otomi through my descendants, through my father, and our clan is then connected to the Otomi Coordination Project, and then, of course, the Coordination Project connected to the Consejo de la Nación Otomi. I think the important point here is that there's a conscious effort to reestablish and strengthen ties and then end the loss of identity among Otomis on both sides of the border. We're not the only ones, you know, having these problems, but, there are problems that are happening in Mexico as well. And the Otomis in Mexico and the United States have been discussing the need for establishing relationships with other Mexican indigenous communities, and that's why I see the work with, Ricardo and the Pascuayaki and our Oaxaqueño brothers and sisters, the Purepechas, because the Frente Indígena has built a relationship or an alliance with the Purepechas who are in Michoacán, and the Oaxaqueños are in southern Mexico. Well, we're right in between that, so there are dialogues between the Frente Indígena and the Otomíes in terms of building alliances. So they, having that alliance, you'll have an alliance of indigenous people from Oaxaca all the way to Michoacán. So those are some of the works that we're doing. And as earlier I mentioned, some of our young people that are here from Fresno, they've been integrated into some of our ceremonies. They're coming to our sweat lodge ceremonies, and they're involved in our celebration. We're having a celebration on October 12th to celebrate our resistance and our survival. And our young people are involved in that. And so that's the sort of thing that we hopefully will see from you, to work with us, because the issues of globalization are our issues, and we have a lot in common, and hopefully it leads to powerful and creative processes that we can be proud of. And with that, I'm going to let Rogelio Mendez give a presentation of the Frente Indígena de Organizaciones Binacional, and Adriana Barraza will translate for Don Rogelio.
Nana, Tata, Naloo, Chaloo, Ñañi, Koba. Dai inindo nikisando kivivichi konisondo ya kakunyo mendi sikanondi yo. Dai inindo nikisando. Dai inin Dios. Dios na kosi mendo nindo nagando yo. Hermanos, hermanas, señoras, señores, muchachas, muchachos.
Brothers, sisters, ladies and gentlemen, young men and women.
Gracias por el tiempo, por su tiempo que nos están dando. Espero que no se empiecen a dormir. Gracias que escuchan nuestra historia. Gracias a Dios, y que Dios también siempre esté con ustedes, así como todos los que estamos presentes aquí.
Thank you for giving us your time, and we hope you don't fall asleep. And thank you for listening to our history, and may God be with you as it is with all of us.
A grandes rasgos, quiero decirles una breve historia de los mixtecos. Soy originario de la Mixteca Baja del estado de Oaxaca. Con la invasión española, nuestra nación mixteca tuvo que abandonar sus casas, sus tierras, y huir hacia las montañas más altas para que no violaran a nuestras mujeres, para que no asesinaran a los hombres jóvenes. Y es así como empezó nuestra debacle, cuando los indígenas perdimos historia, avances, ciencia, las tierras, todos los valores de la tierra y las riquezas naturales.
I am a member of the Lower Mixteca Nation. The Mixteca Nation, and with the conquest, the Spanish conquest, that's when we had to flee and go up the mountains to prevent, you know, flee from our women being raped, and that's how we began losing our history and our traditions, and this is, you know, where we are today. Natural resources, we lost our lands, we lost all of this.
Así fue como los indígenas mixtecos, sin que se nos consultara, quedamos rezagados en el estado de Guerrero, Puebla, Veracruz, y la mayor parte quedó en el estado de Oaxaca.
So this is how our nation got pushed up into Guerrero, Veracruz, and Oaxaca.
Puebla.
En Puebla.
Y desde esos tiempos remotos quedamos en las montañas donde la tierra no es fértil, no produce nada, no se da bien ni el maíz ni el frijol, solo es una cosecha por cada año, y si es que llueve, había cosecha de maíz, calabaza y frijol, y si no había buena lluvia, la tierra no produce.
And since then, those remote times when we got pushed up into these mountainous lands, where the land is not fertile, we cannot grow
calabaza,
no squash, no corn, no beans, and if it doesn't rain, then we can't have anything.
Bueno, pasaron los años. Para nosotros la historia se detuvo, vinieron las guerras, la guerra de la revolución, y aunque Oaxaca tuvimos a un ilustre hombre que es Benito Juárez, él se preocupó por problemas de México nacionales, por problemas de América tal vez latina, y por luchar contra los países imperialistas. Y sus hermanos, los indígenas, quedamos siempre en la miseria. Después vino otro hombre poderoso, de origen español y de madre mixteca, que fue Porfirio Díaz, y pasó lo mismo. Se fue en el poder lo usó para hacerse rico él y el sector que estaba en el poder, y de los pobres nunca se preocuparon de sacarnos adelante.
So years passed and our history stopped, and wars came, and there was a revolutionary war, and from Oaxaca we got a man, Benito Juárez, who took on national problems and fought the imperialists, and our brothers and sisters were left in poverty. And then came Porfirio Díaz, how could I forget? And he did the same thing. Once he took power, he was actually Mixteco. Mixteca mother and a Spanish father. And when he got into power, he did the same thing, leaving our brothers and sisters with nothing, in poverty.
Bueno, después de que pasó la revolución, después de 1917, cuando ya hubo más tranquilidad, fue cuando inicia otra vez la migración de los pueblos indígenas para buscar fuentes de trabajo. Los primeros indígenas que empezaron a migrar fuera de su territorio fue hacia Chiapas, Veracruz, el estado de Morelos y México, Distrito Federal. Hablo de 1920 a 1950, y lo hacían caminando por muchos días, por digamos que por jornadas de 10, 12 horas diario hasta llegar hasta a donde tenían que llegar. Su alimentación era totopos y las hierbas que encontraban en camino, que es comestible para nosotros. Así es como, para poder subsistir, nuestros antepasados tuvieron que salirse de las montañas para ir a buscar fuentes de trabajo.
So after the revolution, after 1917, when there was a more tranquility, is when the indigenous migration begins again. And the indigenous people were had to forced to migrate to Chiapas, Veracruz, Morelos, and the DF. And this happened between 1920 and 1950. The people walked many days, walking 10 to 12 hours a day, eating totopos and what edible herbs were found along the way to survive. And this is how people were forced to migrate in search of jobs.
Hoy en día existen grandes poblaciones de mixtecos en Cuautla, Morelos, en Veracruz, en México, Distrito Federal. Como que del 50 al 70 estabilizó un poco la gente en esas tres regiones, pero poquito antes y en el 70